Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. Today I'll be reading from the November edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. And this first article is out of the prologue section, titled Political Animal. After years of fierce debate, the West's greatest symbol will again roam the plains. Written by Richard Conniff. This winter, if all goes as planned, a caravan of livestock trucks will carry dozens of American bison out of Yellowstone National Park on a 500-mile journey into the past. Unlike their ranched cousins, which are mainly the result of 20th-century attempts to cross bison with cattle, the Yellowstone animals are wild and genetically pure, descendants of the original herds that once astonished visitors to the Great Plains and made the bison the symbol of American abundance. Until, that is, rampant hunting made it a symbol of mindless ecological destruction. When the mass slaughter of 30 million or so bison finally ended at the turn of the 20th century, just 23 wild bison remained in Yellowstone, holed up in Pelican Valley. Together with a small number of animals saved by ranchers, that meager herd became the basis for the recovery of the entire species, bison, which has been nurtured back to strength in the park. Yellowstone has done its job so well, in fact, that the herd now consistently exceeds 4,000 bison, a number large enough to provoke fears of overgrazing in the park and of bison roaming beyond its boundaries. Park rangers have thus had the disheartening annual job of rounding up excess bison for slaughter, or watching some step across the park's northern border into a hunt that critics deride as a firing squad. Relocating the animals would be the humane alternative, except for a scary problem. Ranchers and others have long maintained that bison spread brucellosis, a bacterial infection that is devastating to cattle. A 2017 study by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, however, determined that every case of brucellosis in cattle in the region over the past 20 years came from an infected elk, not bison. That finding has made it harder to argue that wild bison shouldn't be allowed out of the park. The Park Service will ship the bison to the Sioux and Assiniboine tribal nations at Fort Peck Reservation in northeastern Montana. A small herd of Yellowstone bison has been thriving there since a modest 2012 feasibility experiment. The plan is to build up that herd and to create a bison pipeline, says Robbie Magnum, the reservation's fish and game director. As more animals arrive from Yellowstone, the Fort Peck tribes will gradually export bison, commonly called buffalo, on the reservation to start protected herds on other reservations and conservation lands. On a practical level, the relocation program is simply a way to keep the Yellowstone population in check, but it is also much more than that. The move begins to restore wild bison to the Great Plains and the Plains Indians, who depended on them for food, clothing, and shelter. It has a real spiritual meaning for us, says Magnan. The buffalo were taking care of Native Americans from the beginning of time, and now we need to help them. The fates of indigenous people and bison have long been intertwined in the eyes of the government, too. Federal agents 150 years ago proposed exercising control over the Plains Indians by eradicating the bison in what General William Tuckshuck Sherman called one great sweep of them all. Renewed interest in the future of wild bison, including its 2016 designation as the U.S. national mammal, comes as the conventional account of their near extinction is facing fresh scrutiny. The story that eyewitnesses and historians have told since 1870 is that the destruction of the bison almost overnight was the work of ruthless white hunters arriving by railroad and armed with the latest weaponry. But that account may be too simple. Citing fur trade records, archaeological data, and contemporary accounts, environmental historians such as Andrew Eisenberg at the University of Kansas and Dan Flores at the University of Montana argue that white hunters administered the crushing final blow, but only after a century of environmental challenges and Native American overhunting. The spread of horses on the Great Plains in 1680 onward gave tribes a new, highly efficient means of pursuing their prey. More Native Americans were also eking out a living from the fiercely viable Great Plains environment as settlers displaced them from the traditional territories, and commercial demand meant a huge market for bison hides. Other researchers worry that this contrarian version of history will invite misunderstanding. People hear only Indians were involved too, says Philip Deloria, a Harvard professor of Native American history. And that has the effect of letting the others off the hook, and of letting the explicit military strategy of destroying Native American resources off the hook. Deloria argues that the Native Americans' culture, based on the idea of subsistence, prevented them from annihilating the bison in the same way white market hunters did. It's tempting to see a happy ending to this story in the restoration of the American bison. People working together can pull a species back from the brink. Today, bison are considered near threatened by the International Union of Conservation of Nature. But another battle over this shaggy, snorting symbol lies ahead, as ranchers face larger fears about the resurgence of bison herd. Competition for grass, water, and other limited resources vital to their own uncertain future. And this next article is also out of the prologue section, written by Charles C. Mann. It is titled, Going with the Grain. It took thousands of years, but America's founding farmers developed the grain that would fuel civilizations, and still does. Sometimes it's the little things that count. Movie archaeologists are often pictured triumphantly extracting precious objects from the earth, instantly solving long-standing mysteries. Think of Indiana Jones's Cross of the Coronado, Staff of Ra, and Ark of the Covenant. Real archaeologists mostly find small, almost valueless objects, and won't know for years or decades what mystery they are resolving. Consider an ancient ear of maize, which Walter Howe pulled out of a New Mexico cave more than a century ago. Howe worked at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, the repository of this artifact, from 1886 to 1935. A kindly man with a staggering memory who hunted arrowheads as a boy in West Virginia, he spent most of his career on the unsung but vital task of cataloging the museum's collections. But he also took field trips into the Southwest, and in September 1905, he spent 12 days in what he called an interesting cave. It was in a bluff 150 feet above the Tularosa River in New Mexico, about 30 miles east of the Arizona border. Because the climate there is extremely dry, virtually nothing in the cave had decayed. Formerly used by early colonists as a donkey corral, the cave was full of rubbish and the droppings of animals to a depth of up to 8 feet, Howe wrote. Just walking around kicked up a choking cloud of dust that forced researchers to wear goggles and cover their faces. Despite the terrible conditions, the researchers made an impressive haul. Dried turkey cadavers, mammal bones, broken crockery, a brush made from grass, incense pipes, stones for grinding, cigarettes made from reeds, yucca leaf sandals, and about a dozen maize cobs, some with kernels intact. Archaeologists typically call the grain maize rather than corn, because multicolored indigenous maize, usually eaten after drying and grinding, is strikingly unlike the large sweet yellow kernel cobs conjured up by the word corn. Howe was working before archaeologists had the tools to accurately date artifacts or even pre-GPS to note their exact locations. He simply recorded the locale of his finds and carried them back to Washington, D.C. It would be 4.5 decades before Paul Sidney Martin, an archaeologist at Chicago's Field Museum, examined Howe's reports and followed in his footsteps. Most archaeologists specializing in the Southwest believed that its earliest inhabitants were the Anasazi, as the ancestral Pueblo were then known, who built cliff dwellings in Mesa Verde, 225 miles north of Tularosa Cave. But a few experts argued that the Tularosa area had housed a different culture called the Mugian after a nearby mountain range. To resolve what was becoming a bitter controversy, Martin and his co-workers went to Tularosa Cave in June 1950, the first researchers there since Howe. In 2 summers, they unearthed tens of thousands of artifacts, and they made a convincing case that the pottery they found, especially starkingly beautiful black and white remnants, looked nothing like Anasazi handiwork. Among the Tularosa objects were, astonishingly, 33,000 ears of ancient maize. Fortuitously, Martin had access to a brand new technology, radiocarbon dating, just invented at the University of Chicago. It can determine the age of plant remains and other organic materials. Indeed, the Tularosa cobs were among the first archaeological finds ever carbon dated. Martin reported that some of the cobs were as old as 2,500 years. That suggested the cave had been inhabited before the Anasazi. Key evidence, along with the unusual cave artifacts, for a separate Mugian culture. From about AD 200 to the arrival of the Spaniards, the Mugian had occupied most of what is now Sonora and Chihuahua in Mexico, as well as parts of southern Arizona and New Mexico. Their ancestors began as foragers, then switched to agriculture, including the cultivation of maize, which helped fuel the flowering of Mugian culture. The Mugian, in turn, played a large role in introducing maize to societies north of the Rio Grande, a pivotal event as important to North America as the arrival of rice was to China or wheat to the Middle East. Howe and Martin didn't have the scientific tools to analyze the genetic makeup of their maize specimens and trace precise origins or lineage. Perhaps hoping that future researchers would pore over his finds as he had pored over Howe's, Martin and his co-workers sealed thousands of ancient cobs in plastic bags that are stored today at the Field Museum, the world's greatest collection of Mugian artifacts and remains. Lately, researchers using DNA probes and other technologies have been detailing the roughly 9,000-year process by which Native Americans transformed teosinte, the smallest semi-tropical grass with no ears or cobs, into maize, a productive, elaborate plant that can thrive in a cool temperature climate. In a 2003 analysis of cobs from Tularosa and locations in Mexico, researchers found that the earliest samples, some 6,300 years old, were apparently bred by people focused on boosting the crop yield by increasing the size of cobs and kernels. Later, in Mugian times, growers were selecting for starch and grain qualities useful in making tortillas and tamales. The transformation of a weedy grass into one of the world's most important foodstuffs, think of the enormous stalks of corn rippling across Midwestern fields, is far more complex than anything we can do today in a lab, even with all our genetic prowess. How the continent's first farmers accomplished that feat is a mystery. Drab debris found in a cave may hold the clues. Okay, and this next article is written by Andrew Roberts, and it is titled, Churchill Disses America. Our exclusive first look at the diaries of King George VI reveals Winston Churchill's secret hostility to the United States. The gift of a common tongue is a priceless inheritance, and it may well someday become the foundation of a common citizenship. Winston Churchill prophesied in his famous speech at Harvard University on Monday, September 6, 1943. I like to think of British and Americans moving about freely over each other's wide estates with hardly a sense of being foreigners to one another. His mother, having been born in Brooklyn of American parentage, Churchill believed that he personified, he later called, the special relationship between the United Kingdom and the United States. It was a long theme of his. He had been making speeches on the subject of Anglo-American unity of action since 1900, and in 1932, had signed a contract for his book, A History of the English-Speaking Peoples, which emphasized the same thing. If we are together, nothing is impossible, he continued that day in 1943. If we are divided, all will fail. I therefore preach continually the doctrine of the fraternal association of our two peoples, for the sake of service to mankind. He proclaimed that doctrine for the rest of his life. Indeed, on the day he resigned the premiership in April 1955, he told his cabinet, "Never be separated from the Americans." Throughout a political career that spanned two-thirds of a century, Churchill never once publicly criticized the United States or the American people. In all of his 16 visits to the United States between 1895 and 1961, with eight as prime minister and almost half of them after 1945, he studiously confined himself to public expressions of support and approbation. Yet, as I discovered while writing my new biography, Winston Churchill, Walking with Destiny, he often took a very different stance in private. from a variety of news sources, including the wartime diaries of King George VI in the Royal Archives at Windsor Castle, opened to me by the gracious permission of Her Majesty the Queen, it is clear that Churchill regularly expressed searing criticism of the United States, and especially the administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt during World War II. The newly published diaries of Ivan Maisky, the Soviet ambassador in London from 1932 to 1943, verbatim were cabinet records that I discovered at the Churchill Archives, and the papers of Churchill's family, to which I have been given privileged access, all provided confirmation. As the first Churchill biographer to be allowed to research the King's unexpurgated wartime diaries, I was surprised at the depth of ear that Churchill sometimes directed toward Britain's greatest ally, indeed in many ways Britain's savior. Much can be put down to the frustration he naturally felt toward American military non-intervention in Europe until after Adolf Hitler declared war on the United States on December 11, 1941, but there was a good deal of anti-American venting thereafter too. Churchill's relationship with his mother country was much more complex than the Harvard speech and the rest of his public stance implied. Although he had enjoyed his first trip to the United States in 1895 at the age of 20, Churchill's initial attitude toward Anglo-American unity was sarcastic, bordering on the fastidious. When his mother, the socialite Jenny Jerome, proposed publishing a magazine dedicated to promoting that idea in March 1899, he wrote from Calcutta, where he was serving as a junior cavalry officer, that the motto she wanted to adopt, "Blood is thicker than water," had long ago been relegated to the pothouse music hall. He sneered at her concept of printing the Union Jack crossed with the stars and stripes on the front of the cover as cheap and told her that the popular idea of the Anglo-American alliance, that wildly impossibility, will find no room among literary ventures of the day. From the beginning, his attitude was one of clear-eyed, unsentimental realpolitik. "One of the principles of my policies," he told his mother in 1898, "will always be to promote the good understanding between the English-speaking communities, as long as the interest of two nations coincide as far as they coincide, they are and will be allies. But when they diverge, they will cease to be allies." Churchill fully appreciated the United States' entry into World War I in April 1917. "There is no need to exaggerate the material assistance," he wrote in his book, The World Crisis, "but the moral consequence of the United States joining the Allies was indeed the deciding cause in the conflict. Without America, the war would have ended in peace by negotiation or, in other words, a German victory." In the 1920s, Churchill was highly critical of the United States' determination to build a fleet equal in power and tonnage to the Royal Navy's. There can really be no parity between a power whose navy is its life and a power whose navy is only for prestige, he wrote in a secret cabinet memorandum in June 1927 while he was Chancellor of the Exchequer. "It seems to be assumed that it is our duty to humor the United States and minister to their vanity. They do nothing for us in return but exact their last pound of flesh." The next month he went much further, writing that although it was quite right in the interest of peace to say that war with the United States was unthinkable, in fact, everyone knows this is not true, for however foolish and disastrous such a war would be, we do not wish to put ourselves in the power of the United States, evidently on the basis of American naval superiority. The next year, speaking after dinner to the conservative politician James Sycamore Gore Wedderburn at Churchill's country house, Chantwell Manor in Kent, he said that the U.S. was arrogant, fundamentally hostile towards us, and that they wished to dominate world politics. Herbert Hoover's election to the presidency in November 1928 made matters worse. Because of his tough stance on British repayment of war debts and the effect that had on the economy, which Churchill was still stewarding as chancellor. "Poor old England," he wrote to his wife Clementine. "She is being slowly but surely forced into the shade." Clementine wrote back to say that he should become foreign secretary. "But I am afraid your known hostility to America might stand in the way. You would have to try to understand and master America and make her like you." But his hostility to America was not known beyond the inside government, as he assiduously kept it out of his many speeches. The outbreak of World War II naturally intensified Churchill's determination to allow no word of public criticism to drop from his lips, especially of Roosevelt. Considering the smoothing words he always uses to America, noted his private secretary, Jacques Colville, 9 days after Churchill became prime minister in May 1940, and in particular to the president, I was somewhat taken aback when he said to me, "Here's a telegram for those bloody Yankees. Send it off tonight." During the Battle of Britain, Churchill said the Americans' morale was very good in applauding the valiant deeds done by others. A week before Roosevelt was reelected in November 1940, Colville recorded in his diary that Churchill said he quite understood the exasperation which so many English people feel with the American attitude of criticism combined with ineffective assistance, but we must be patient and we must conceal our irritation. Any hope Churchill had that Roosevelt's electoral victory might bring the United States into the war against the Nazis had evaporated by New Year's Day, 1941, when Britain faced bankruptcy because it had to pay cash for all the munitions and food it was buying from the United States. Churchill told Colville, "The Americans' love of doing good business may lead them to denude us of all our resources before they show any inclination to be the Good Samaritan." As well as expressing those criticisms to his private secretary and to some cabinet colleagues, Churchill also told the monarch what he really thought of Roosevelt and the Americans. His relations with King George VI were not initially good, but when he became prime minister, largely because Churchill had supported the king's elder brother Edward VIII, later the Duke of Windsor, during the abdication crisis 4 years earlier. But during the months of the fall of France, the Battle of Britain, and the London Blitz, they swiftly improved, and by 1941, Churchill was confiding in the king at their private lunches at Buckingham Palace every Tuesday. They served themselves from a sideboard so that no servants need be present. And after each meeting, the king wrote in his diary what Churchill had told him. His diary is held in the Royal Archives at the top of the Round Tower at Windsor Castle. The tower's origins may be traced to the 11th century, soon after the Norman conquest, but King George IV added the top floor in the early 19th century. Because there are no elevators, every trip to the summit involves a mini workout, which is rewarded by magnificent views of Berkshire and the surrounding counties. But I had little time to gaze out the window as I made the most of my extraordinary opportunity to examine King George VI's diary, which I was allowed to do one blue leather-bound volume at a time and under constant oversight, even on trips to the lavatory, though the staff, even while providing such eagle-eyed supervision, was unfailingly able and friendly. "The Americans are all talk and do nothing while Japan lands fresh forces in Sumatra, Sarawak, and elsewhere," the prime minister complained to the king soon after Pearl Harbor was attacked in December 1941. A month later, he insensitively added of the dangers of the Japanese invasion of Australia. "The U.S. fleet would have prevented this from happening had her fleet been on the high seas instead of at the bottom of Pearl Harbor." That April, as the Japanese naval threatened Allied shipping in the Bay of Bengal and the Indian Ocean, he said, "We are in a hole, and the U.S. fleet is in San Francisco doing nothing to help." On New Year's Day, 1943, Churchill said of his future Allied strategy, "We have to collaborate with the Americans over these matters as we cannot do them without their help. They are so slow in training their army and getting it over here." Churchill was clearly jealous of the leading position the Americans had assumed through their vastly superior production of war material by the spring of 1943. "Winston is keen on his imperial conference," the king noted that April, "so as to discuss the question of putting up a united British Commonwealth and Empire front to show the world and USA that we are one unity. The Americans are always saying that they are going to lead the post-war world." A week later, the prime minister expressed his completely unfounded suspicions that the U.S. really wants to fight Japan and not Germany or Italy. By October, he was insisting the U.S. cannot have supreme commanders both here and in the Mediterranean, and we must not allow it. The Med is our affair, and we have won the campaigns there. That was not true either, as the king must have known. The U.S. Army fully shared the trials of the Italian campaign from the invasion of Sicily in July 1943 onward. And indeed, it was the American general Mark Clark who was the first to enter Rome on June 5, 1944. In March 1944, Churchill likened the strategic situation in Europe to a bear drunken with victory in the east and an elephant lurching about in the west, while we in the UK were like a donkey in between them, which was the only one who knew the way home. By July 4th, nearly a month after D-Day, he was reporting to the king that, over his pleas to Roosevelt to fight in the Balkans rather than the south of France, he was definitely annoyed at FDR's reply and put out that all our well-thought plans had been ignored by him and the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. A month later, he worried that with Generals George S. Patton and Omar Bradley advancing faster in Germany than General Bernard Montgomery, the two Americans may want to separate their army from ours, which would be very stupid. Yet there was not a whisper of this antipathy in Churchill's telegrams to the Americans, let alone in his public references in the Commons and his broadcast to his allies. He ripped up many bad-tempered telegrams to Roosevelt before sending much more temperate ones. In particular, he kept private his resentment that the Americans did not support taking a tougher stance against the Soviet Union over Polish integrity and independence after the Yalta Conference of February 1945. Winston was not satisfied with FDR's reply to his telegram re-Poland, the king noted on March 13th. It was much too weak, and the Russians want to be told matters strongly. The next month, Churchill told Clementine, "Undoubtedly, I feel much pain when I see our armies so much smaller than theirs. It has always been my wish to keep equal, but how can you do that against so mighty a nation, with a population nearly three times your own?" It was impossible. But while Churchill is often accused of appeasing the United States, in fact he promoted Anglo-American unity because it served Britain's best interest, his public reticence to criticize the United States reflected two aspects of his character that were often to the fore throughout his political career. The first was his capacity, ruthlessly, to sacrifice the trivial and the short term for the greater prize. The second was his powerful sense of personal and national destiny. He foresaw a time when Britain would need the United States desperately. So alongside this article, there's a famous photograph of Joseph Stalin, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Winston Churchill sitting together at the 1943 Tehran Conference. There have been talk bubbles inserted above the heads of each of the three men in this photograph. And the title of this reads, "With allies like these, the big three worked together to end World War II, but behind their public partnership, there were private put-downs." And so now the bubble over Joseph Stalin's head on Roosevelt says, "And Roosevelt? Roosevelt is not like that. He dips in his hand only for bigger coins." On Churchill, Stalin says, "Churchill is the kind who, if you don't watch him, he'll slip a kopeck out of your pocket. Yes, a kopeck out of your pocket. By God, a kopeck out of your pocket." And above the little bubble over Franklin D. Roosevelt's head is a comment on Churchill. He is a mid-Victorian on restoring the British Empire. Dear old Winston will never learn on that point. And finally, on the bubble over Winston Churchill's head is a comment on Stalin. "Trying to maintain good relations with a communist is like wooing a crocodile. You do not know whether to tickle it under the chin or to beat it over the head. When it opens its mouth, you cannot tell whether it's trying to smile or preparing to eat you up." Well, that's all the time we have for today on the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the November edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. Thanks for listening to Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. So long until next time.